The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
So, Jake, apparently we have the next guest on the line, Jacob. And you actually set this up. How the hell did you pull that off?
I sent
him an email.
Oh, you sent Jacob an email.
Yes. And do you prefer Jacob or Jake?
I prefer Jacob for the people that have never met me. My friends call me Jake.
Okay, so we're...
I understand that. I have the same dilemma.
So I will call you Jacob until we become friends, maybe?
Sure.
So you've come along and really merged what we wanted to see. That is real life with real life bloggers. And you've put yourself into these just... in my opinion, outlandish situations, these situations where I personally would not want to go.
That's what I've heard. It's sort of like a vacation in hell.
Jacob, could you give us some background? I mean, number one, who are you? How do you explain who you are? And number two, why have you done what you've done?
Well, I'm Jacob Applebaum from San Francisco. I grew up in a small town near there. I'm a freelance hacker and photographer, although I'm not a professional photographer. I don't really sell my work. I just take photos and give them away under Creative Commons licenses. Low-flying airplanes, fun times. Sorry, it's a little bit noisy here because of all the military aircraft.
So you're still in New Orleans right now?
Yeah, I'm in Algiers. I'm on the corner of Atlantic and Alex. So it's actually after curfew, but the power's on in this neighborhood. It's one of the first neighborhoods with power because of the city council saw what Malik Rahim was doing with the community, and as a result, they really put a lot of pressure on places to really get this place up and running because there's a lot of people that couldn't evacuate, like people with gangrene, people that are really sick, people that have no place to go, no vehicles, no money, not even food.
How long have you been in New Orleans now?
I've been here for about a week. Give or take a few days. I was in Houston before that. Joel Johnson and I, he flew from New York. I flew from San Francisco. We met for the first time in the airport, and then from there we've sort of driven a van from Houston to Baton Rouge through Morgan City on down into New Orleans.
And what compelled you to do this?
Well, as far as for coming to New Orleans, I called up a personal friend of mine, Shani Jardin. She runs Boing Boing, or one of the co-editors of Boing Boing, I should say. And I had just been laid off from my job the Friday before I had called her. So the very next day, I called her and I said, you know, I'm really disturbed by how much the federal, state, local officials have dropped the ball. From what I've heard on the ground, there are people being murdered left and right. There's people that are just in absolute dismay and no one's taking accountability. No one's fixing things, and everybody is passing the blame. So I decided that I wanted to do something, and I asked her what I could do if she knew anyone. She's very well connected, and sure enough, she hooked me up with Joel. So decided to go.
But this wasn't your first, I guess, excursion. You went to Iraq.
Yeah, I went into the northern Kurdistan area of Iraq. In April, from the 14th to the 28th of this year.
Why? I mean, this is a simple question. Why?
It's a really long and complicated and unsimple answer, unfortunately. But the long story short, I had some serious issues in San Francisco where some people did some very bad things. And I decided that I needed to leave. And while I was gone, I felt this compelling need to sort of go somewhere where things that were bad in a way that I could hopefully change them, that I could share perspective on it. And in a way, I mean, openly and honestly, I was partially either going to commit suicide by going, or I was going to live through it, and hopefully the parts of me that needed to die would die off, if that makes any sense.
So it was more of a journey into yourself, more than a journey overseas.
It was both. I mean, I traveled through many places, not just Iraq. I went through Vienna, and I went through Istanbul, I went through the Czech Republic, I went into Iraq as well. I was gone for a little maybe like a month and a half. I don't really remember. But, I mean, for the most part, the reason that I went was of a my father was murdered by some junkies in San Francisco, and the police basically refused to investigate it, and that sort of caused me to have a little bit of an identity crisis, a little bit of a human crisis. I felt like totally alone and denied by the world, so I decided that I would go to a place that was full of people who were alone and denied by the world.
So were you sympathetic, then, to a certain part of the Iraqi cause?
Well, it's weird, right? It depends on what Iraqi cause. I mean, I feel like all of those people over there are humans, and I know that there are a lot of people that are pretty upset about the so-called insurgency, and there certainly is an insurgency, don't get me wrong. There are some really bad people over there doing some really, really bad things. But some of those people are you and I, also, and there's no doubt about that. These people, if someone invaded America, I would take up arms to defend my country. There's no question about it. When I see my family slaughtered in the street by an army machine gun because they just happen to be driving while brown, then I'm pretty sure that would really lose me as far as the occupying army goes.
How easy was it to get to Iraq earlier this year?
It's extremely simple. I mean, I wouldn't do it just because things are easy. I guess easy for me and easy for someone else might be different. You fly into Istanbul. I flew from Toronto to Vienna. From Vienna, I flew to Istanbul. From Istanbul, I stayed with a friend for a while, and then I flew into a city called Diyarbakir, which is in southeastern Turkey. That part of Turkey is considered to be pretty dangerous, and a lot of people warned me against going there, but it's really not. I mean, it's a perception thing, right? When I was in Israel, I heard people saying, "You lived in Oakland? Now that place is crazy." Right? So it just really depends. When I was in southeastern Turkey, it's very funny. I got to the airport, and this little kid had a sign with my name on it, because I had prearranged a driver through friends in Iraq that were not part of the military. And the guy spoke only Kurdish and Arabic, didn't speak any English. They made me wait in this room for a long time, and then finally someone came along and I said, "Is your name Mohammed? Mohammed?" And he's like, "No." I was like, "Are you Iraq? Yeah? Yes? No? Kurdistan?" And he's like, "Yes." And so we just got in the car. It wasn't even the cab driver I had contacted, and we drove for hours and hours along the border of southeastern Turkey near Syria, down into the city of Zakhau, which is pretty much the one mutual word that we knew other than the word for water and tea. So it was an interesting drive, like parts of the road just completely missing. Military checkpoints, looks like something out of the movie Brazil, you know, these huge, crazy-looking guys in weird protective gear that just huddle out of the bushes with machine guns to stop your car, and, you know, that's before you get to Iraq.
When you were questioned, what kind of questions did the military ask?
Well, you know, it's funny. There is no military at that border that asks questions. When you go to the border, the taxi cab driver is paid about $100. Gets paid $100 for the ride from Diyarbakir to Zakhau. And, you know, it's customary to tip them another $20 for saving your life and getting you through everything. So when you get to the border, which is right the Kurdish-Iraqi border and Turkey, they say, "What is your purpose here?" And I said, "I'm a tourist." And they started laughing. And then they eventually stamped my little piece of paper inside my passport. I tried to give them incentive to stamp my passport because I really wanted a stamp in my passport. And they refused even when I tried to give them money for it. But there were no Americans there to ask questions. And they spoke so little English that there was no interrogation, nothing. You know, I just basically sat around and waited. And then eventually went through 60, you know, different steps to go through the bureaucracy, eventually just to be dropped off by a cab driver in a little tea house where I sat and drank chai and ate some strange bread that when you go into the kitchen, you see they're just like making it on old rusty pieces of metal, and it's another world. Very sad, very poor.
When you went there, did you know that you were going to be blogging and taking photos of this entire experience, or did that kind of happen and spring out of you actually being a tourist to use your word, in this part of the world?
Well, I don't really consider myself a tourist, but I thought that that was probably the best answer that I could give to them. I consider myself more of a traveler or a wanderer than a tourist. You know, I mean, tourists stay in hotels. I basically stay with friends. You know, I meet people on the internet and things like that. So I did a lot of internet organizing, meeting people, talking with them. Like, I used this blogging tool called LiveJournal, and I met lots of people in Turkey, and that's one of the reasons I decided to go through Turkey and stay in Istanbul for a while. And so I had been blogging photographs and all sorts of things on my LiveJournal for quite some time before I went into Iraq. And in a way, it was I felt after the personal tragedy that had befallen myself, and I suppose my non-existent family at that point, my way of communicating with my friends in a way that wasn't always constantly a burden to them about that tragedy was by showing them, here I am in Toronto, here's some beautiful things that I've seen today, here's, you know, some writing, here's what's going on with me. Because there was no other real way for me to communicate with the outside world.
And you had nothing but good experiences with meeting people using the internet?
Well, I had some bad experiences, but when you're 6'2", white male, traveling, generally, even though I have a Jewish last name and an Israeli stamp in my passport, nobody really gave me trouble. I certainly had some weird looks. You know, I have kind of funky sprocket German glasses and, you know, an asymmetrical haircut. I sort of look like Alan Cummings and Titus, you know, and my clothing sort of reflects some other weird quasi-military, you know, dress. So people probably thought, like, at least in Turkey and Iraq, they probably thought I was kind of like a really weird American contractor or a Westerner. And I would actually try to speak German to people when they would speak to me in English so that I would, they wouldn't think I was an American.
Really?
But I never had any really bad experiences. No one really, you know, meeting me online, promising to help me out or to meet me somewhere or to show me around and then not. The people that I met, I checked their references. I made sure I read about them. I looked around. I did as much research on people as possible, and things worked out.
And how long were you there?
I was just there for 2 weeks in Iraq. Hmm. But it's strange when you're in a really intense, both emotionally and physically, emotionally trying situations like that, they really, it feels like it's a lot longer. You know, the very first day Joel and I were here, like, geez, I can't believe we've been here for several days already. And then we both looked at each other and we're like, we've only been here for like 18 hours. You know, it's like the first or second day we got here, we saw, you know, a dead body that had been on the street for about 10 days, I think, or maybe it was like, I think it must have been like 6 days at that point, but it stayed there for several more days. Only a couple of days ago did they clean it up. It's like when you're in a situation like that, you have these, every day you have 50 events to report back on about your life. When you just reflect internally, you really feel like you've been somewhere a lot longer. You feel really affected by it. I mean, the people that I know in Iraq, even though I only knew them physically for a couple of weeks, I'll never forget about them and what they've been through. And because of the dynamic, I certainly have a lot of sympathy for them. Can't just discount them. I know that they are human. They're not the enemy.
You've been in a war zone, and you're in what some are calling a war zone. You made mention of a dead body that may have been there for days, if not close to a week or more. There's an interesting correlation that might be happening here between what you saw in Iraq and what you're seeing in New Orleans. Is that accurate to say that the experience has been a little similar on some levels?
I'm going to have a photography show likely in San Francisco, but probably in Toronto, and I'm going to call it American Disasters. And it's going to be a juxtaposition of my trip to Iraq as well as my trip to New Orleans. And I can tell you that there are certainly similarities, but make no mistake, what's happening in New Orleans is different, and that when the community here is rising up to empower themselves, to educate themselves, they're not being struck down by the people in power. They certainly were abandoned. They certainly were receiving no aid. And many people were shot, as I've been told, by police trying to leave the city. And that man whose body I saw down the road, he did not die from the hurricane. I mean, if he died from the hurricane, it must have been the aftermath of the hurricane, as people like to call it. And I'd say that there certainly are aspects. The media control is very big. I mean, Americans are well known for shooting journalists in Iraq. Reporters Without Borders has talked about this, the stuff that's happened at the Palestine Hotel. I think there's been almost 20 journalists that have been killed in Iraq. I mean, I saw The Control Room, which is obviously a biased movie, but it was interesting to see Al Jazeera targeted and actually bombed by American forces. I mean, there's no question that there's that aspect is pretty brutal. I've heard, you know, military people threatening journalists here. I've heard, you know, a lot of people saying that they have no problems. I personally have been told to keep moving. You can't be here. And they, like, push you out of the way, block your cameras and things like that when they're removing bodies or...
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans, yes. I've not heard of any journalists being killed here, but I have heard of many journalists having guns turned on them, being told that if they don't remove their film, that they'll be shot. Journalists having their cameras broken. Journalists being turned away. And I did hear a rumor of a journalist being shot but not killed trying to enter New Orleans, but I'm not actually sure if that's true. That was about a week and a half ago. Before I came here, I heard that, and people were cautioning me against going here. But I can't say that this is like an extreme war zone. I mean, there are certainly parts of it that are absolutely devastated. There are certainly parts of it that are scary to people that are not, you know, they're not used to this kind of thing. But this is a war zone light in some areas and is very heavily fortified in other areas. So depending on where you are, like Algiers, because of the community organizing, because of the community really rising up to meet their needs and to really help the people, it's not a war zone here. It's peaceful. This was a dangerous neighborhood. It is not dangerous anymore.
Now, Jacob, what's keeping you in New Orleans right now?
What's what?
What's keeping you there?
Well, right now, I'm here with Joel Johnson from Gizmodo, who's now freelance. But he and I, we had this idea that we wanted to help some people out. And a close friend of mine referred me to another friend of mine that I'd worked with previously. I worked with him in Oregon and Greenpeace doing some media stuff, taking photographs and organizing some protests against old-growth logging. And this person contacted me and said, Jake, I need your help. We need communication. We need a comm center in Algiers. And Joel and I, put together some equipment lists, figured out what we could do, and Joel had an EVDO card, it's a Verizon cell service, works in a laptop, basically like slow DSL, but it's wireless. And trying to get DSL here, I'm sure it would take a while to get a circuit provisioned. So being able to do that, we were able to bring a comm center. We got a multimedia center set up yesterday, and the method we use to teach people is we teach them how to teach. Because I'm not going to be here forever, but those people are going to be here, and they're going to have more time than I have just by myself. So they teach other people in the community, and those people teach more. And then as a result, we had, you know, a dozen-plus people yesterday learning how to make Ethernet cables, setting up the computers, getting onto the Internet, learning about IP addresses. And so what keeps me here is the idea that I'm helping to educate a populace so that it can empower itself. And I'm certainly not doing the majority of the work, and I certainly am not. I'm not responsible for the good work being done here. That's Malik Rahim. He's the one that's doing this. He's the one that's bringing people together, and he's uniting them. Regardless of politics, everyone knows that these people need help, and a lot of it is because of the storm, but certainly a lot of it has to do with the inherent racism and classism of this area, and not just of the area, but of people in general. They think, oh, black people shooting each other in the streets in New Orleans? Well, of course. That's what poor people like that do. Things like that are really counterproductive, and unfortunately, that's how the media has spun this entire event, when in fact it wasn't like that at all. The people, I mean, certainly there were some thugs shooting people, but the real bad stuff that happened here was the government, the local, the state, and the federal government turning their backs and often turning their guns on the people here.
Have you seen that happen, or have you just been someone who's been hearing stories about these things, or have you witnessed anything that I guess you would consider horrific in person as it was happening?
I generally wear a press badge, which I made myself, that personally has kept me because of the, by the time that I got here, when I was out taking photographs openly, CNN had sued FEMA. I believe it was FEMA that they sued, so that they could take photographs and videotape the body removals. And they'd won. So at that point, the military had really stopped cracking down on the journalists in the areas where I had been. I certainly have not been on boats with cops. I certainly have not been flying in helicopters with the military or the Coast Guard. So I have not seen the really big, incredibly volatile photograph situations, like the situations where when you photograph it, people look bad. Like I heard via email, someone sent me an email, a friend of a friend is an authority figure in New Orleans, and they said there were over 500 bodies in the Astrodome and an incident involving many school children. If I had been there with a camera, maybe something bad would have happened. Maybe someone would have threatened me. But because that event was not covered by me, I didn't receive, I mean, I wasn't in a situation where they would point guns at me. I mean, you have to, of course, know when to pick and choose your battles, right? You don't go up to a group of soldiers and try to take their photograph in an antagonistic way, or you will get a gun in your face. But just last night, there was a guy walking back to the medical clinic after curfew, which is, depending on who you ask, 6 or 9 o'clock. Big difference, though, because one is light out and the other is very dark. And he had guns thrown on him by a number of people, and only because he was white, I think, and he thinks, and most of the black community around here thinks, he was treated in such a, basically in a safe way, because they saw him, he's in a medical outfit, in smocks, and so they only pointed 5 guns in his face. So, no, I have not seen that personally, but I know that it's here, and it's around, and it just depends on the situation that you're in.
When you went to New Orleans, was this kind of an extension of the reasons why you went to Iraq, or was it more based in a motivation that you were there for a purpose other than blogging and covering and just doing something that seemingly most of America was not?
Well, it's a couple of things. I came here because I have skills that I was told were needed. But I knew that before someone had told me that, someone that I'm friends with had told me that I was needed here, I knew that my skills would be needed when I started hearing about the things that happened, both as a documentary photographer, but also as a network, you know, engineer or software developer, right? So something I could help with that is not just manual labor, but also manual labor, but something like that that I could help with. And I just knew that I could help. And I knew that since I'd been laid off from my job, that I had no reason to stick around. My company was closed down by the parent company that owns it, and as a result, I had no reason not to go. But in a way, I think that everything is an extension of what happened to my father. In a lot of ways, that really plays into a lot of this. I mean, when you see the incredible injustice that I've seen in different places that I've been, including in little San Francisco, California, it makes you really think about things. When you hear about major injustices where the world has our attention, it certainly makes me think that I can do some good. And I knew that if I came here, if I came and took photographs, if I wrote about it from my personal view, and I knew that I wasn't owned by any company, I'm not being paid by anyone that, you know, to write a certain way or to cover a certain angle. In fact, no one gave me press badges, for example. I mean, everything that I've got, all my credentials are like, I joined a 501c3 that's sort of involved with the FCC, CU Wireless. So then I have some documentation that says that I'm with Part 15 in the FCC, and that helps me to get through places, to help them with their telecommunications infrastructure, but also to use that infrastructure to show the world, to help solve the caring problem, where people don't care about these problems unless it's in their face. So by bringing those photos to them, by writing about it on a personal level, by using names, first names, showing their plight, showing people who are being helped by this community, it brings it home to them, and it really helps them. And all the other skills that I bring to the table, I feel, as well as all of the dozens of people that are here, they all help as well. And whether or not they all intended to help in the way that they did, we all pitch in for anything we can.
In your opinion, and I'll let this be the last question because I'm sure it's kind of getting late there. In your opinion, has the media been responsible in New Orleans?
Well, I guess it depends on what media you're talking about. I hear that the body count is a lot lower than they expected. I wonder where they're getting their figures from. Recently, I heard that the company that is doing the body removal is well known in the world for losing bodies and miscounting. Very close friend of the Bush family. Well, this sounds like just partisan BS. I looked it up, and certainly it seems to be true. To me, the media not reporting on that, the media not being at Malik Rahim's house in Algiers to talk about the community release, the media here, they're responsible, but they're responsible for making everyone think that it's just a bunch of black thugs killing each other. They're responsible for making everyone think that this is a hopeless situation that was caused by the people here, when in fact, it wasn't just caused by the people here. The people here were thrown into this situation. People knew well in advance that this hurricane would strike, but most of the time, most of the people that died, they died after the hurricane. They died from cops pulling guns on people on bridges. They died from shooting each other in the convention center. They died from people beating them to death in the Superdome. They came from all sorts of absolutely terrible things that could have been prevented if the media had cameras on the ground, if the media had some gonzo people that were really willing to be in the thick of it, that were willing to do things without the protection of the police. If they all cower in their safe areas of the city, they don't go out, they don't go looking through things. They're not. I mean, if you read the on Boing Boing recently, there was an anonymous letter. There's been two anonymous letters to Shani Jardin by a cameraman that's down here, and his letters really outline this. He's working with, I assume, one of the larger corporate news companies, and it seems like it anyway, because he seems to be around that. And what he says is they just cower. They just hide. And sure enough, when I drive through the city, I don't see them anywhere except downtown. I don't see their cars driving anywhere except through the French Quarter. They're covering this from well, this is where tourists used to show their breasts, so this is an important area of economic development. This is what matters. But this isn't what matters. It's that whole area downtown, Bush showing off on that ship. You know, these things, they just take away from the real needs of this community. And New Orleans being the center of it is also quite ironic, because there are places in Mississippi and Alabama that are gone. Entire cities vanished. And you don't hear anything about it, because nobody cares about these small towns. Because it's not about human life. It's about rating. It's about people coming and thinking about, I had a nice vacation in New Orleans, and it's really terrible what's happened there. Those thugs. When in fact, that's not the case at all. The media misportrays so much of it, which is why I feel like multiple perspectives of bloggers can really help out. Because, well, I'm certainly biased. I'm open about that. And while I'm certainly showing you a skewed perspective through my filter, you know that. There's no doubt about it. Fair and balanced? I guess you could say that some of those news networks are fair and balanced, but you'd be lying.
Jacob.wordpress.com is where you've been blogging. This is your home on the web?
That's one of them. That's one that I set up specifically for this.
Specifically
And my photos are flickr.com/photos/IOError, and my email address is jacob@appelbaum.net. Applebaum.net.
Jacob Applebaum.
Yes.
Well, we'll be following you closely as this continues to happen and wherever you happen to go next.
Great. Thank you.
No, Jacob, thank you. And I can't imagine, I can't even imagine, Iraq, New Orleans, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. You've got so much.
If you have a chance, or if any of your listeners have a chance, I highly recommend you come and see Webzine, webzine2005.com, because there'll be a lot of people sharing their experiences. Independent publishers, people that I've been meeting, travelers who sail in boats without engines down to Mexico without radios, just sail down, you know. It's an incredible storytelling going on by people who are not living normal lives.
Yeah, tonight we actually spoke with Eddie, and then a couple weeks ago we spoke with Scott, Scott Beal, both of whom are involved with Webzine. And
both good friends of mine, very, very good men.
Well, then you're all in good company then, and hopefully one day, you know, Jacob, if, you know, as we continue to follow what's going on and help kind of spread the word about what you're doing, maybe one day I can call you Jake. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, who am I speaking with this time?
Hey, this is Ted.
Hey, Ted.
How you doing?
Thanks for holding.
I survived.
Yeah, you were actually caught in the Hurricane Katrina.
I was. I felt it. I got blown around with the wind, and I was in the thick of it.
Now, where, to remind everybody, where are you living right now?
I am in a small town called Pascagoula, Mississippi, which is about 20 minutes outside of Ocean Springs. Ocean Springs was devastated.
Did you lose anything of substance in this storm?
Actually, I was extremely, extremely lucky. The only thing I lost was an area rug that I had in front of my couch. The water apparently was waist high, but the door seals apparently were strong enough to hold most of that out, so I only had a quarter inch water in my apartment.
Wow.
So
that's
other
impressive.
People, what's that?
That's impressive that the door seal was that good.
Yeah, I know. I was really impressed, especially considering the age of these apartments, but I took a ride down towards the beach, and I sent Ponzi some pictures.
Oh, okay.
I actually have, I have them posted now that I got internet access back. I got it back yesterday.
Are you using your cell phone for internet access then?
No, I'm using my cable modem. I got, like I said, I got my internet access back yesterday.
It's good to know that they're starting to restore things slowly but surely.
They are. It's slowly getting back to normal. It went from people pulling guns for gasoline and water to sort of back to normal now. I mean, there's still debris everywhere, but stores are starting to open. Walmart's opening at a limited hours, so we're getting there.
Did you go anywhere during
I went about 30 miles east to Grand Bay, Alabama, which isn't that far, but it was far enough. Where I wasn't here. No.
Well, we're glad. We're glad you're okay.
Oh yeah, I'm glad I'm okay too. But I've been to Iraq in Desert Storm back in '91. I've seen buildings blown up by artillery, leave more structure than this thing did. Mm. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, I know that. I think was it Noah? Basically came out and said that this was the worst, I guess, weather-induced incident.
The worst hurricane ever to hit the United States. I read that just a little bit ago while I was on hold, actually.
It's no surprise. I mean, I've now had to kind of tune out everything on television just because, I mean, I can only take so much of it. And, you know, I can take the initial hit, but then after a while... much like with any big media story, I have to tune it out just to get anything done.
Yeah, well, you know, you see it on TV and you see the pictures, and even me, you know, I saw the pictures before I come home of the devastation, and it didn't really sink in until I actually went down to Beach Boulevard and I walked down the beach, and just where once were multi-million-dollar homes, these vacation homes, were nothing left except slab, and I just put on the website there where my pictures are posted,
okay.
Which there aren't very many.
Well, what we might do is we'll probably put what you've said in with the interview that we did with Jacob.
I haven't been to New Orleans. I don't want to go to New Orleans. What you have to realize is New Orleans wasn't affected as much by the hurricane as Ocean Springs was. What happened with New Orleans was the levee, or the levees that hold the Gulf of Mexico and Lake Pontchartrain back, broke and flooded the city. That's their main problem.
Yep.
It wasn't the wind damage.
Yep.
It was the fact that their levees busted and they knew it was coming. That's what gets me. New Orleans knew it was coming. They had emergency drills for it, but they really didn't seem to know what to do when this happened. So.
Well, we appreciate you checking in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, by the way, water out of a computer. Any ideas?
You know, when you asked that, I didn't really even think about the fact that it could be water-related, because I assume this is related to flooding.
Yeah, well, actually, it didn't get a whole lot of water. It's just that I forgot this computer in my closet. I didn't see it. I put my other one up
high. Letting it dry out and hoping that the sediment doesn't ruin anything is probably your best bet.
Well, I don't think the motherboard got that. I think it was just because it's one of those that sits up on its side. Or sits up a tower, sure. I guess is what you call it.
Well, like
it's
I said...
the only thing that got wet.
If you have a wet dry vac to suction up any kind of outstanding water or any standing water...
Well, it's dry now. I think the only thing that got wet was the video card.
Okay. Well,
I would maybe remove the video card.
Possibly. Yeah. You could try booting it up. I would just watch yourself when you do, because Sparsh could very easily fly, and be ready to either not necessarily unplug it, but you know, turn off the power.
Right.
There is a potential. It is shot. If you have a spare video card, certainly you could replace it, but it wouldn't necessarily mean that the video card was busted if there was any water damage in there. Any kind of sediment or residue may be just as damaging as the water was after the fact, after it was dry.
If you have anything of any importance at all on the hard drive, you may want to remove the hard drive and back that information up off the hard drive before you try to boot it.
Well, you said this was in a closet. Was just kind of an old computer, spare computer?
Well, it's sort of a spare one that I haven't used for some time, and I just forgot it was even in there. It was one that I was planning on putting Linux on at one time. I was planning on maybe making it into a server, but, of course, I don't have the know-how to do all that, so that's why I listen to your show.
Ha! Well, someone actually recommended, and, you know, I've never done this before. I've never had water damage in a computer, but someone said or suggested to use distilled water to flush out the sediment. Which is, you know, certainly a possibility, and adding more water to it could be more damaging. The damage may already be done. It's really difficult to say at this point.
Well, you know, I heard a lot of these computer stores down here or computer repair places are using some sort of silicone or silicone-based spray or something to that effect that actually repels the water.
You mean, inside before or after?
After.
How...
I don't know if the silicone is the right word, but it's some sort
like
of spray.
After the fact.
After the fact. They're actually bringing these computers back that way.
Interesting.
I had one gentleman tell me that he's brought like four of them back so far.
Well, that may be the way to go. I've never heard of that before, but I can only imagine that's going to be in high demand in the coming months for people who are in similar situations, only in more
dire need. Yeah, my brother-in-law's a contractor, and he's got work out of his ears right now.
Oh, I bet.
So, I bet. You know, it's just we're coming back from it, and we're gonna rebuild. We're gonna rebuild bigger. The casinos out here were just totally devastated. They were literally picked up and put, you know, into the parking lot of the Coliseum.
Which is funny. I mean, in a sort of way, because gambling is illegal on land, but not in the water.
Well, it was. Because of this, they're actually going through Congress now to get authorization to build them on land now. Because, you know, they were on barges, and that's why they moved so much, because the water literally lifted them up and moved them into where they shouldn't be. So now they're talking about either putting them on stilts or building them on land or land-based.
Well, keep us posted on what happens with the waterlogged computer.
Oh, I will. I definitely will.
Thanks again, Ted.
The Windows Media Stream for the live broadcast of The Chris Perillo Show is provided by Limelight Networks. Listen to the live Chris Perillo Show in Windows Media Player. Download the latest version of the player for Mac and Windows users at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.